Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. The state of Delaware is handing DuPont millions of dollars in incentives to keep jobs here post-merger with Dow. But not everyone thinks that's the best idea.
I use the phrase, this is sort of a pray and spend approach, and I don't think that's responsible.
Political reporter James Dawson examines the question of how the state will pay for all these incentives. President Obama's historic visit to Cuba made headlines this week. We learn more about conditions there from a Widener University Delaware Law School professor who recently took a group of students there. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We'll also learn more about a Wilmington-based organization that advocates for homeless women, the increasing number of community-supported agriculture programs in the state, and we'll meet a pair of William Penn High School students whose passion for sports analytics is drawing attention. The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground, is next. But first, the latest news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Back in 2012, Delaware Public Media contributor John Hurdle introduced us to Deborah Gilbert White, a homeless advocate who herself had been homeless for a time in 2011. Since then, White has started Her Story Ensemble, a one-woman nonprofit that encourages women who are homeless or may become so to speak out to others in the community. Her premise is that ending homelessness won't be achieved through short-term handouts of food, clothing, or legal advice. It can only be accomplished by helping affected individuals recognize that they have the power to get a roof over their heads and get their lives back to full function. Recently, John caught up with White to update her story as Her Story Ensemble prepares to hold a benefit next month and hand out its first advocacy award. John's piece is available right now at DelawarePublic.org, and he joins us on The Green this week to talk about it. John, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
Well, first off, tell us a little bit more about White's Her Story Ensemble and where she's at right now.
Well, this was this is a group that was set up in early 2014, and it's really based on White's own experience as a homeless person. She was out; she was without her own home for about 5 months during 2011, and about 1 month of that time she spent living in a shelter. The remainder, she was staying with family members, always been involved in social advocacy of various kinds, and her own experience of homelessness led her to set up this group, and she focuses on homelessness for women in particular, and she justifies that by saying that well, for one thing, as a woman herself, she clearly identifies with the problems that homeless or near homeless women face, and she also argues that there are by reaching out to women who are affected in this way in the community, she will also. She'll also help children who are associated with that with those women. And the way she works is that she invites what she calls members of the organization to speak to community groups about their experience, whether they are currently homeless, whether they are formerly homeless, or whether they're at risk for becoming homeless. And her main aim is one of education and awareness. And she feels that that is the long-term answer to homelessness rather than providing short-term handouts like cash payments or clothing or legal advice or whatever it may be.
And certainly her organization is somewhat unique in its scope and its focus, but there are other initiatives that are going on in Delaware to help the homeless. Tell us a little bit about some of those and what other people are trying to do to get at this problem.
Well, I think that one of the initiatives, just to go back to White's own group for a second here, I mean, one way that she's hoping to direct public attention to the issue, or perhaps to renew public attention on the issue, is to, as you said, Tom, to hold this benefit and awards ceremony at the end of April. At which she will be presenting an award to another homeless advocate, a lady called Veronica Scott in Detroit, who's set up a company to to manufacture coats for the homeless that are able to turn into sleeping bags. So this sounds like a very practical method, but White is saying that this is consistent with the aims of her own organization.
Are there some other things that are going on statewide to try and get at this?
Well, indeed, there are. There's a new bill, a revived bill going through the state legislature. It's called the Homeless Persons Bill of Rights. And what this aims to do is to prevent discrimination against homeless people who may be trying to obtain housing or use public transportation or obtain other services, and who may be subjected to rejection by those operators simply on the basis of the fact that they are homeless. Now, there was a very similar bill that was introduced in the legislature in the previous session. It did not become law because they ran out of time. So it's coming around again. It's expected to get a hearing in a Senate committee in the middle of April, and the lead sponsor is Newark State Senator Brian Townsend, and he told me that that homelessness is a complex issue that's not necessarily very well understood by the general public. But acting against discrimination is one aspect of it, and it's one aspect that can potentially be addressed by the state.
You mentioned that the Townsend said this is a very complex issue, and we've seen someone like Ms. White, who's working on homelessness for women. We've seen a number of initiatives both here in the state and nationwide to address homelessness among veterans. What are some of the challenges that, generally speaking, are facing homeless people both here and elsewhere?
Well, if you speak with Deborah White, what she'll tell you is that the principal challenges, the principal underlying causes of homelessness in the state are, number one, a shortage of affordable housing, and number two, a minimum wage, which she believes should be raised. Beyond that, I think, beyond those specific recommendations, I think that advocates for the homeless will tell you that there is a lack of public understanding that homelessness can not only affect people who are, for instance, the typical public stereotype of a homeless person probably is an older male who may be out on the streets and subsisting on handouts. But in fact, the homeless population is a lot more complex than that, advocates say, and so it does clearly include women and children.
And based on that, I mean, do we know how much the Delaware's homeless population is either or growing or shrinking at this point? Do we have a kind of a grasp on what the situation is right now?
Well, Senator Townsend says that there was a survey done by the Homeless Planning Council of Delaware in 2010, which estimated the total homeless population of the state at about 6,000 people. His own impression, he said, he didn't have any more up-to-date figures than that, but his own impression is that that the population has stabilized. And he assumes that it's been helped by an improving economic environment. Even if the population has stabilized, or maybe it's even started to decline somewhat, in his view, that's not good enough. We all have an obligation to find ways of driving it down.
All right, John Hurdle, we appreciate your time this week. Thanks for joining us on The Green.
You're welcome.
That is Delaware Public Media contributor John Hurdle. Again, you can read John's piece on Deborah Gilbert White and homelessness in Delaware right now at DelawarePublic.org. And next on The Green, we chat with a Widener University Delaware Law School professor about his recent trip to Cuba with a group of students. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. President Obama's historic visit to Cuba this week put the spotlight back on the effort to normalize relations between the U.S. and that communist island nation. While the United States' 54-year-old trade embargo of Cuba remains in place, work to open doors between the two countries has been moving forward at a strong pace since December of last year, when Obama announced his plan to push toward normal relations. Among the opportunities that push created came at Widener University Delaware Law School, which earlier this year took a group of students to Cuba for 3 days as part of its new Business Transactions in Emerging Economies course, created in part to take advantage of the opening in Cuba. Professor John Colhane led the Delaware Law group that made the trip, and I spoke with him earlier this week about what he and those students took away from it. Professor, my understanding is the Business Transactions in Emerging Economies class that made the trip to Cuba is the first at Delaware Law to integrate foreign travel into a class. What did you see as the benefit of taking the class on the road in that way for students working in this area, offering counsel to businesses that are working to tap into these emerging economies?
Well, besides the fun, you mean?
Yeah, exactly.
So it was great fun, right? And the students really enjoyed the trip. But, it's part of this move toward experiential learning that we're hearing so much about in law schools. And this was really a good way of doing that. So the students had classes during the semester where they learned, generally about how business gets transformed and done, right, in emerging economies. But there was a specific focus on Cuba, of course. And then when we were down there, the students were able to see firsthand the emergence of small businesses, talk to people that had worked in government and people who were like academics. And we even had a chance meeting with the fellow who worked at the U.S. Embassy who gave us, some insight. I think just seeing and hearing people, but more than that, kind of traveling around the country, particularly Havana, and seeing the transformation underway, I think really puts, kind of content and substance in a very real way to what they were learning in class.
And I was going to say, Cuba is probably about as unique and experiential type of situation as you can have right now.
Absolutely.
In this realm.
Absolutely is. We were all saying, students and faculty alike, that it would be really interesting to take, literally a snapshot of different streets in, Havana and look at it 10 years ago, look at it now, and look at it in 10 more years, because the kind of transformation that it's undergoing right now as they move very tentatively toward more of a free market economy and are really starting to undertake massive infrastructure repairs, which have been delayed for decades, you really do see, literally right before your eyes, you see an economy that's changing and evolving.
And you, I understand, had the opportunity to meet with some of the business leaders, the political folks, to kind of understand, the lay of the land at this point. How much did you learn there about just, what folks on the ground in Cuba are dealing with right now as these changes kind of wash over the country?
Yeah, so we did have a chance to talk to a few owners of private restaurants and businesses, and they were talking about how, that's changed and how they're able to keep more of the money that they're earning than they used to. One of the things I found most interesting was in listening to people that were more in the academic realm talking mm-hmm. about what life was like in Cuba. And they have a completely different prism, a completely different way of looking at what goes on in the U.S. and what goes on in Cuba. So from our perspective, we look at the political prisoners and the human rights violations, which are well documented by all kinds of, nonprofit and human rights advocacy groups. From their perspective, they look at the incarceration rate in the U.S. or the fact that not everyone has access to free health care as human rights violations of a different kind. So it's just interesting when you get a different perspective. We kind of start from the premise that, well, we make a lot of mistakes, but basically the way we're doing things is right, and they start from the opposite premise. And I think it's really instructive. I was sitting at lunch one day talking to a couple of the students, and at our table and at the next table, there were these really great discussions going on about the various, merits and drawbacks of both systems. And I think that's exactly the kind of thing that
I was hoping the students would get out of the trip, and it really seems to have been successful in that way.
It seems to me that you had that opportunity to kind of glimpse the day-to-day life in Cuba as much as anything else. And overall, what is your sense of the Cuba that people will find today?
I think people, it's sort of this great mystery, right? Because
right.
It's been so difficult to get there. I know people have gone through, you know, other countries and hoping that, you know, they wouldn't get their passport stamped in Cuba. So it's only been very recently that things have started opening up. And, you know, people, I think, might picture these ancient cars, right? That's sort of one of the first visual images that comes to mind. And they're still there. I mean, they're mostly kind of novelty taxis, but there are also some of them that are still on the road. You know, they've really made the best of very limited resources. I mean, think about what's required to keep a 1950s car on the road, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's kind of a romantic slash mysterious view of Cuba that people have. And I think when one goes there, you know, a lot of that is kind of verified. I mean, there's a lot of singing and dancing and, you know, a lot of people that seem, you know, seem happy. Now, a lot of the tour is stage managed to an extent because
sure.
the government runs a tour company. But we went out and went to, you know, dance clubs. We went to Buena Vista Social Club, which was a highlight. We went to a very cool art gallery slash dance place slash performance space that was extremely cool. And, you know, got to talk to everyday Cubans. And it was just a great experience all around. I really recommend the trip to anyone. You have to be a little adventurous, right? It's not like going to London or Paris, but it really is a terrific adventure. And I think, I know I talked to some of the students this morning, and they said they had a post-Cuba depression for a few days when they got back because they really so greatly enjoyed themselves while there.
I did want to ask you, I mean, there is so much going on now, but, you know, your visit there, you know, the president's visit this week, you know, Major League Baseball has a team down there playing this week.
Yeah,
but
cool.
from the, you know, the kind of the nuts and bolts legal business logistics standpoint, I mean, this is still a process that's very, very much still at the beginning, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we still have the embargo in place.
Right.
You know, until that's lifted, there's sort of a limited amount that Cuba can do in sort of world markets in terms of obtaining materials, in terms of obtaining financing. But my strong suspicion is, well, first of all, Obama's done what he can to sort of nibble around the edges of the embargo and, you know, looked at certain exceptions to what can and can't be delivered to Cuba, but also in terms of getting tourists there. Just last week, there was a huge change whereby you really no longer need to even go with a group. You just have to basically say that you're going for educational purposes, go to a few art galleries, check them off, and you're there. So that really is a huge a step.
Mm-hmm.
And I think whoever the next president is, perhaps unless it's Ted Cruz, who has a very strong view about the embargo, but really if anyone else who's currently a contender gets in, I really think the embargo is not long for this world. There are just too many business interests that support changing it. And the resistance of Cuban Americans really is a generational thing that's starting to fade out as, you know, second generation Cuban Americans are looking at this as kind of an artifact of the Cold War, even though there are still huge problems in Cuba in terms of, you know, human rights and political prisoners. I think the dominant thinking has become, well, the way to deal with that is to throw some sunshine on it and to get more involved with Cuba. And it's not like we're dealing with China or Vietnam that are thousands of miles away. They're 90 miles from Key West. You know, I think the proximity and the close connection between a lot of people in the U.S. and people still in Cuba will accelerate the push of Cuba in a more market-based economy and perhaps with more of an eye toward reining in some of the human rights violations. And I think it could be instructive to us also. It's not a one-way street. They do a lot of things really well in the realm of education and healthcare that we could learn from. So I'm very optimistic going forward that the changes will really benefit both, you know, both countries.
Our thanks to Widener University Delaware Law Professor John Colhane for joining us this week on The Green. And next up, the First State is throwing a lot of incentives DuPont's way to keep jobs here after its planned merger with Dow. But how will the state pay for the millions of dollars it's investing? We'll talk about that more next. But first, your local news from Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green. I'm Tom Byrne. Governor Jack Markell joined with legislators earlier this year to furiously cut corporate taxes. And just recently, they signed off on new or reworked tax credits as part of their pitch to Dow and DuPont to keep a presence in Delaware. The two chemical giants were impressed enough to headquarter two of their projected spinoff companies here. But as Delaware Public Media's James Dawson reports, no one has figured out how to pay for most of the multi-million dollar deal just yet.
Governor Jack Markell and state lawmakers have widely lauded an incentive package as part of an effort to retain DuPont jobs in Delaware and the tax revenue they generate, but they're largely ignoring the bill that comes with it, which totals tens of millions of dollars. Markell's proposed budget for next year covers the initial $8.2 million hit expected in 2017 when they passed legislation that lowered corporate taxes in January. However, Finance Secretary Tom Cook says there's no current legislation in the pipeline to cover an expected $54.6 million tab that's either lost through lower business taxes or spent on a handful of tax credits during the next 2 years.
I think that's obviously going to create some tough decisions. I still agree that that was the right thing to do, but it is going to make resources limited in the future.
Representative Paul Baumbach, who has spoken out against the spending on credit approach the Markell administration has taken, says, quote, "We're cutting ourselves off at the knees after fiscal year 2017. He says the organic economic growth from this package won't cover the drop in revenue.
I think that the magnitude is much smaller than what's hoped for. I use the phrase, this is sort of a pray and spend approach, and I don't think that's responsible."
He voted for what's been called the Delaware Competes Act, which modified the way the state calculates corporate income tax. It also changed which times of the year small business owners have to pay those taxes. But Baumbach didn't cast a vote either for or against a bill that sailed through both chambers last week, revamping or reviving two separate tax credits that incentivize research and development and for bringing high-salary jobs to Delaware. Perennial budget pressures like more people signing up for Medicaid, miscalculations in projecting public school enrollment, and ballooning state employee health care costs have continued to mount in recent years and will be competing with the unfunded incentive package for those dollars. Senator Brian Townsend also registered concern with a lack of comprehensive action on a set of recommendations from a much-hailed task force that focused on lowering Delaware's reliance on certain income streams.
These are important changes. These actually are common sense changes, but why are we waiting until economic danger is here to make these kinds of changes?
Townsend helped write those recommendations. They included making those changes to Delaware's corporate tax structure, but they offset the drop in revenue by tweaking other taxes as well, something that hasn't been talked about at all during an election year.
Overall, yes, it's being ignored. I think people are taking a look at the revenues we have this year and trying to craft a budget, and it's unfortunate that such hard work, such a deep dive into Delaware's revenue streams is at this point on the shelf and is not part of the conversation.
A bill ready to be put on the House agenda would raise the ceiling on the state's corporate franchise tax, something that Baumbach and Townsend both say should be looked at, though no department has done a financial analysis on how much money it would raise. It was being seriously considered as an option last year, while leaders of all four caucuses forged a late-night deal on transportation funding June 30th. Now, it seemingly has little chance of passage. Senate Minority Whip Greg Lavelle says his caucus has given it no consideration.
I could argue for a tax cut in fiscal 2021, saying I know, and you don't know this for sure, but the economy is going to be so strong, then we should cut taxes now. So, you know, like it or not, the reality is we do these things 1 year at a time, and so that's how we're going to do it.
Senate Republicans broke up a Democratic supermajority in that chamber in 2014, which allowed them to block any proposed tax or fee increase with just one vote. Lavelle says he doesn't expect the budget process to become more inclusive over the next 3 months, allowing lawmakers to punt on the issue into 2017 and an entirely new General Assembly and governor.
The process seems to be on a track that will get him and the chambers out of here without too much rigmarole, and those decisions can always be revisited next year, and will likely have to be.
James Dawson, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, James. You can find James Dawson's ongoing coverage of the legislature and politics in the First State anytime at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. The Green continues in a moment with a look at the growing use of community-supported agriculture programs, or CSAs, in the First State. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Spring is officially here now, and with it, farmers and gardeners across the state are back outdoors prepping and planting as the new growing season gets underway. In recent years, some of what's grown across the state is increasingly finding its way to consumers through community-supported agriculture programs, or CSAs, where people can pick up boxes of locally sourced fruits, vegetables, meats, and other foods at distribution points from Wilmington, Delaware to Salisbury, Maryland. Contributor Eileen Dalabrita took a look at local CSAs for us in her latest piece, available right now at DelawarePublic.org, and she joins us now to tell us more about these farm-to-table programs. Eileen, thanks for coming back to the show.
Good to be here, Tom.
Well, let's start with a thumbnail sketch of how CSAs actually work.
Well, consumers essentially buy shares. They commit to picking up or having produce delivered to them once a week, once every other week, once a month. But it is a contract. It is a commitment. You do essentially pay up front to get these goodies. And then you just get whatever is running that week, whatever's good, whatever's ripe, whatever is fresh.
And what kind of places are generally running these programs or serving as access points for CSAs?
Well, there are a lot of family operated farms and also places of employment where there are perhaps the starting point is typically about 20 members. So they farmers are delivering to offices like Capital One Bank, Dover High School, Wilmington Friends School. You can pick up your produce at select YMCAs. So there are lots and lots of ways to get your hands on these goodies.
And you mentioned that many of them start as 20-person shareholder type of operations, but many of them are much, much larger than that now. How quickly are they growing, and what's the appeal?
They're growing very quickly. Pfeiffer Orchards in Camden, Wyoming, they started their program 5 years ago with 90 members. They now have 750 members who pick up either at the farm or at 14 different distribution sites throughout the state. They are resonating with consumers who want to buy locally, who are very concerned about having healthy food, and also who want to support local businesses.
And obviously the benefit, as you said, the consumers is having a pretty easy way to get this fresh produce into their kitchen. Are there some other benefits for CSA members to getting their produce and such this way?
Yes. You get a lot of different products that you don't find in a typical supermarket. Things like heirloom tomatoes and Japanese cucumbers and graffiti eggplants, black raspberries, specialty crops, and you also can, in a number of CSAs, you can actually designate the ripeness of what you want. I'm going to be away for 3 days. Make my tomatoes not quite so ripe. I want to have that melon tonight. Can you give me a really ripe one?
I was going to say, that's got to be an interesting thing to have, as you said, some of these specialty-type items beside the kind of run-of-the-mill produce. And I guess a lot of that just depends on what's being grown locally and what is good to grow locally.
Yeah, and consumers also have the option to expand their boxes with things like fresh eggs that have those gorgeous orange yolks that you just don't find with eggs that have been on the shelf for a while, where the yolks have turned yellow. You can add things like grass-fed beef or locally raised turkeys, honey, jams that are produced by various farmers, fresh baked bread. You can go as big or as small as you wish.
From the people you talk to, is the appeal the variety that you're mentioning, or is it maybe a little bit more skewed toward the healthy part of it, knowing what's in the food that's on your table as opposed to wondering, well, I got it at the store. You know, what's really in this? You know, what chemicals might have been involved in making this?
I think that that is a big part of it, is the healthy eating, the local eating, and because it isn't shipped from vast distances, it's very fresh. I also think that there's tremendous appeal toward eating with the seasons. Mm-hmm. This year, because of our very mild winter, we are going to be seeing asparagus 3 weeks earlier than usual. To see those very tender radishes that are fresh out of the earth. It's strawberries that were just picked that day. It's really great stuff.
And how about for the farmers? What's the benefit to them?
It's tremendous for the farmers. The farmers are getting money up front. They are also that they can use to buy seeds, to plow into their operations, literally. And that they also have that immediate feedback from consumers face-to-face. And they're talking directly with their customers who are telling them what kinds of things that they would like to see so that they pick right in what they grow, that they're going to pick things that they can sell that people will really like. Plus, the farmers aren't having to invest as much time into, say, going to a farmer's market. You pack everything up, you take it to the market, you set up the tables, you're there all day, and it rains. And then you pack everything back up, and you take it home, and it doesn't look as good as it did in the morning, so you have to mark it down or give it to a food bank. You don't have that with a CSA. You put it in a box. People come and get it, or you drop it off, and you've already been paid for it, and you know that there is no waste, that everything that you packed is going directly to the consumer.
What's the easiest way to find a CSA?
Well, we'll have a list of places that people can look, but also, if you want to look by zip code anywhere that you live, you can go to localharvest.org and plug in your zip code, and you can find a number of different CSAs that are near you.
All right, Eileen Dalabrida, thanks so much for being with us this week on The Green.
Thanks, Tom.
Again, Eileen's piece on CSAs is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. Next up on The Green, it's this week's Enlighten Me, where we meet a couple of William Penn High School students who are garnering attention for their work in sports analytics. This is Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. A new baseball season is almost here, and one of the things that fans of the national pastime have always enjoyed, and at times obsessed over, is the host of statistics that go with the game. From traditional batting average, home runs, strikeouts, and ERA, to newer ones like walks and hits per inning pitched, or WHIP, and wins above replacement, or WAR. And those statistics in recent years have really started to shape the game. Use of analytics to rate players is used much more to help teams decide how to build their rosters. It's so prevalent that it's finding its way into schools. Take William Penn High School, which, under the guidance of a teacher, Brian McNulty, started its own sports analytics club 2 years ago. And two sophomores in that club, Umar Khan and Tyler Schatzenbach, recently did work so impressive for the Martha's Vineyard Sharks, a summer collegiate team, that their work is taking them to next month's Carolina's sports analytics meeting at Furman University. For this week's Enlighten Me, I sat down with Umar and Tyler to talk about their work and sports analytics in general. Well, before we talk about your presentation, I just want to hear from both of you. How did you get interested in sports analytics? We'll start.
Well, I was approached by Mr. McNulty in my freshman year of high school with an idea for a new type of club. And since I'm all for innovation and technology, I jumped on the opportunity and seized the moment. And we just grew from there, working on smaller projects and eventually making it to bigger ones, such as the Martha's Vineyard Sharks project and the LA Aviators, which we're currently working on.
And for you, was analytics something you already had an interest in, just on your own?
Analytics was nothing that I ever really thought about. It wasn't really anything that I knew much about. Mm-hmm. I've always heard about things like Moneyball and so on, and I've been interested, but I've I haven't really had an opportunity until Mr. McNulty approached me, and I was very eager to jump on it.
How about you, Tyler? How did you get interested in analytics?
Well, in addition to Umar, I was also a student of Mr. McNulty originally, and he brought me along with the club as like one of the, I guess you could say, founding members, you could say. But like, I really, really liked the idea of analytics because I like sports myself. I love baseball. Baseball's my favorite sport. And I jumped on the opportunity because I know Mr. McNulty can provide opportunities that no other teacher here can provide. I know that because he's provided me with opportunities that I know I couldn't have gotten if I went to any other school but William Penn.
The club itself, you said, is relatively new. Tell us a little bit about what some of the things you work on in the Sports Analytics Club on a regular basis.
We started small in the club. Originally, just started from analyzing current events in sports, like how regular player performance in the major leagues at the time, new football data. It really varied, but eventually we made to bigger things. But we started small and gradually worked up to more harder things, you could say.
I was fascinated by the possibilities, and that's what I've worked for the past 2 years, because our first project was with the Blue Rocks, and which is a local baseball team here in Wilmington, Delaware. And I knew at the time that it was a good opportunity, but I always wanted to grow, and I wanted to create something bigger. I wanted to create a legacy that we can leave at William Penn.
Let's talk about this specific project. What is it? What did you study in this particular project?
We studied the quality plate appearances in a major in a baseball setting, offensive category. And quality plate appearance is basically how well a batter worked a pitcher in a certain at-bat. So that could range from many things. That could range from a walk, that could range from a run being scored, a hard hit ball, just getting on base in general. There are many different ways a quality plate appearance is categorized, but we basically studied how well a certain team was in a certain statistic, and quality plate appearance was that's a statistic.
And was the idea to study that first and then you connected with a team, or did you have an opportunity to connect with a team and then decide that was the statistic you were going to look at?
We started off looking at these statistics and then we applied that towards our team and in the game. And we got very good results. We got a lot of new types of data that we haven't looked at before, and we were able to make some conclusions that we haven't been able to make before. And in the end, we got a very good season. We did not go all the way, but we won the regular season title.
And I guess tell me a little bit about how you wound up connecting with, which team was it again?
The Martha's Vineyard Sharks. They're a collegiate baseball team in Martha's Vineyard.
And how did you wind up getting connected with them and using them as the team you were studying?
Mr. McNulty reached out to them, and they welcomed us with open arms.
So walk us through a little bit of the process of what you did with the team.
So basically what we did was through our group members that we had going into the project, we basically cut the workload between every single group member. What we did was we basically said this group member is going to work on tracking actual game data sent by the team through email. And then while another person would be working side by side with Mr. McNulty on basically analyzing the data collected from the game. And that was basically how we organized the data, how we could visualize the data in a very simple manner.
And talk to us a little bit about the actual process, the amount of hours you had to work on this. What give us a sense of what it was like from start to finish to collect all this data and then work with it and get to the final conclusions you came to.
Well, we worked over 50 hours in the summer. We looked at more than 1,400 plate appearances, and we looked at a lot of data. And I specifically worked with a lot of the PowerPoints and spreadsheets with all the offensive data and player by player, and I had to break it down with the help of Mr. McNulty, looking at different graphs, looking at different averages, and trying to find new types of analytic data that we can provide to the team, which will be beneficial in some sort of way.
I guess the big question then becomes, what did you find? What did you learn from analyzing all this data, and what was the feedback you were giving the team that you felt helped them?
Through the data, we basically understood who were the stronger hitters on the team, who were the weaker hitters on the team. Going in, we had no clue of how good each player was. Basically, we had just a basic research day on every single player in the league, in the whole league, but also on the team. On the team, but through the season, we would gradually understand like who is better than one player, and through that, we would basically make a generalization of who would be best in a certain situation. So we would basically, you can say, organize the starting lineup in that way. Stronger hitters would be in more prevalent areas to score runs, while weaker hitters would probably not play at all that current day.
And for you, I mean, were there any things that you found surprising going through the process in terms of what you were able to learn and glean from all this data?
I was surprised by how many talented players we had. For example, Ryan Kelly, Brian Campbell, and Cam Disarena, these are some of our best hitters and very, very talented players who've really carried their weight in the team and led us to the season that we have. And I was amazed by it because it was something that I didn't really think would happen when I was going into making this project, working with Tyler and Mr. McNulty side by side.
For you, I mean, you said you were a baseball fan, yeah. Tyler. Does analytics change the way you watch games?
This completely changed the way I looked on baseball. I mean, watching games in general, really, it makes you feel smarter as a baseball fan, and it just makes you feel like you have an inside edge on the actual game. You understand the game more. You feel like you're more into the game than an average fan, but it doesn't really take away from it.
There are plenty of old school baseball fans and scouts and the like who look at analytics and say, well, you know, you still need to just watch the player and figure out the intangibles. What do you say to people like that who maybe don't buy into analytics as much as yourselves and others who in baseball have started to put more weight on them?
I agree with that to a certain degree. I feel like you can learn a lot from watching a player. You can learn a lot about how talented they are, what is their method for playing, how they think. But using analytics helps you break all that down even further and helps you predict the future more. Watching a player, you can't really predict what they're going to do next or how they're thinking or where they're going to hit this ball. With analytics, you can predict that.
For you, do you feel that maybe there are some who are just a little bit too resistant to using the numbers in concert with the old eye test?
Yeah, but I would say, like, again, with Umar, it really does change the way you do watch baseball. Going back to the last question, I mean, you do learn a lot. I mean, going in, I learned absolutely nothing about the players. And through more research and through analyzing data provided by them on the field, I mean, I've grown to know these players and their morale and just everything really about their game.
So do you guys look at this as something that you may pursue in the future as a career possibility in college and beyond?
That's not something that I've thought about too much. I'm a young entrepreneur. I'm very, very interested in business. But this is a possibility. This is something that I do like and enjoy, and I am willing to pursue it beyond high school. And I haven't given it much thought yet, but I do look forward to it. It's not something that I can talk on yet.
Tyler, you seem pretty anxious about answering this question.
going in, I knew, like, this could be a potential career path. But the whole idea of this was having fun. Mr. McNulty's provided me an opportunity that I really can't pass up because he's taught me things about the real world and just getting ready for the future. I don't have to take the idea of analytics and really make it a hobby. I can really put it on my own career idea, which is in information technology, since I study it here at William Penn. But, I mean, going in, it wasn't really originally something I would pursue, but now it is.
I was going to say, a lot of times you hear students say, I don't understand why I'm learning this in math. I don't see how it's going to apply to me in the quote-unquote real world. Do you feel like you guys are kind of the answer to that question, that you're showing how you can take these concepts and apply them to a real-world situation?
I've actually said that in math class on certain occasions, because not everything we learn in math class will be applied to real life, and my teachers have agreed to this. But you can apply anything to any part of the world if you want to. Everything relates to something somehow. It just is depending on how you perceive it.
Same exact idea as Umar. Like, we've all been there. We've all thought, like, this will never help me in the future. But really, analytics is just a prime example of how you could actually implement it into a real business setting. I mean, I've learned how analytics can literally change the way a baseball team can play, how players can interact between each other, how they can learn.
Finally, I mean, how excited are you guys to have a chance to go down to South Carolina and show your work off to a group of people who are obviously, you know, really invested in this type of work?
Words can't describe how excited I am, actually, because I've worked a very, very long time in silence. I haven't told anybody about all these successes that we've had, and I just like to keep it a secret. And now I can really open up and show all my friends and family and relatives about how far we've come.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited. I mean, we've always been talking about doing potential outside things besides just working with teams at school and over the summer. But this is just a reminder that everything we do is worth it in the end, and everything that you basically work on will have a payoff. This is, like, again, with Umar, what Umar said, keeping it a secret. I've actually been doing that too, but our success really can't be described in words because we've been learning stuff that we can carry out of high school to the real world and through our careers and lives.
Our thanks to William Penn High School sophomores Tyler Schanzenbach and Umar Khan for enlightening us this week. They have a GoFundMe page up and running to help pay for their trip to next month's Carolina's Sports Analytics meeting, and you can find that at WPHSSportsAnalytics.com. And that's all for The Green this week. Remember, the stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website and on iTunes. We also want to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributors Eileen Dalabrida and John Hurdle, Delaware Public Media's James Dawson, as well as our president and station manager, Casey House. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne. Thanks for joining us. The Green will be taking a spring break next week, but we'll return in 2 weeks with a new show. Join us again then.